After several years in higher ed, including senior administrative roles, he now serves as the professor of theology and philosophy at Concordia University, Irvine. Jeff is also one of the hosts of the Virtue in the Wasteland podcast. In addition to his broad academic interests, he enjoys riding beach cruises with his family up and down Balboa Peninsula, or riding his new era Triumph up PCH from Newport to Venice Beach. You're also, Jeff, the only person who could get my parents to watch Tree of Life, so thank you for that.
I'm sorry about that.
Would you guys welcome Jeff Mallinson?
You'll do me a huge favor. It'll be like a little spiritual high five if you continue to use the restroom while I'm speaking. As I was sitting there, I was thinking how I really needed to use the restroom. And yet there was someone speaking there. And that would be awkward for both of us. But now it won't be awkward. Now it will be an act of love. You will say that we are loving towards one another and that we have the kind of gracious relationship, although we've just met, that you could pee very near to me and to the microphone. But I can't hear it. Can you hear that? I can't hear anything. And even if we could, life is too short to stay there and hold it in.
Get busy.
So please do. The fact that sit right here, you know, like you were naughty in grade school. Now listen, I'm hoping you're having a great night. I'm having a great night. This is great. I'm having a great week, and I didn't realize how great my week was until something interesting came in the email, but I got to give you some backstory. Every month, because my son's middle school got hacked by a Russian hacker, they tried to compensate us so that we wouldn't sue or be angry, you know, as parents. Apparently, their other parents, they're mostly older than I am, and my wife, we got married young, and the first one was an accident, beautiful boy. You're married, but the great thing was we don't really care, you know, as much as Irvine. If you go Irvine's, I hate Irvine, least sexy city in America. But you must understand the parents are very, very intense. You know, it's like Chinese acrobats and Honey Boo Boo. You're just saying, I'm glad your kids are really doing well. But they're in a living hell, and I'm very sorry for them. And so I just kind of want to walk up to them and say, hey, if you ever just want to play Xbox, come this way. That would be weird, right? Because you can't just walk up to... But the spirit, that's what I wanted to say. But anyway, I'm having this great week because my son gets this hacking thing, and we have nothing to lose, so you can steal what you want, I suppose. My identity is whatever. And in fact, go do something exciting and get me some notoriety, that might help. But I get every month, I get this email that I just delete every month, and it says, hey, you know, well, we've got an update on your credit, and I don't want to look at this credit. Because I started out, you know, I've never not had a job since I was 19. I've always paid my phone bill. My car has been paid off. Everything's great. But I was as a young man, I found myself in an administrative role. I was the academic dean at this, I was a dean of theology at Colorado Christian University out in Denver. And I had this beautiful home. As a young man, I had this beautiful home near in Evergreen, Colorado. There's a lake, and we had elk in the backyard. I had to honk the horn to get the elk off my driveway, and that was making me happy every morning. And the lot next to us wasn't developed, and so my children could snowboard down this hill. I had everything I needed. But then this Republican senator who dropped out of college became the new college president, and he hated everything I stood for, so I just left, which was the right thing to do. And I got a promotion, because now I'm really moving along, and I moved to this place in Seattle, a new college where I was academic dean, but I didn't realize that somebody forgot to tell me that 2008 was not the year to sell a home. So even though I thought I'd done everything right, I had to eventually, you know, empty out my bank account, empty out my retirement, and I still had to short sell the house. And I thought, well, I'm going to just roll with the punches. And I thought I rolled with the punches. I didn't realize I wasn't rolling with the punches until this week. This week I realized, once something had changed, how much this had been oppressive to me. I felt very impotent. My talk is about sex and sexiness. And I felt very unsexy because, you know, a man needs to be able to either slay the elk or have a house with the elk or whatever to be successful. And I walked over down here. I went to get my new Triumph, my new Era Triumph. I just wanted to get a $9,000 bike, and I couldn't qualify for a loan for a bike. And I have all this cash, but my credit's bad. And so last month, for the first time in a long time, I just wanted to take a peek at my credit, my way of understanding whether I am sexy or not in the eyes of the world. Am I a trustworthy man? Am I somebody that you would let have $9,000 of a bank note, you know, and not abscond with it to Mexico or something? And apparently, no, the answer is no. You are not worthy of that. And I don't own a house, and it's really hard to explain to people why they should let me rent from them. And I've never had a meth lab, because I'm not smart enough in the science classes. So I get this email, and I said, I'm just going to check, maybe it got better. And it says, it's a form letter every month. Dear Mr. Mallinson, your credit score is such and such. And this means, and this was last month, this means that 0% of human beings in America have worse credit than you do. Have you seen some of the sketchy people that walk around down here by the water? Zero? There's not a single person in America that has worse credit than me. I have never not had a job since I was 19. I'm a theology professor at a college. Now, we don't get paid a lot, but surely 0%. And then this week, I got an email, and it said, something has changed. I said, that's good. I could either be negative. It could be like you owe points on your credit. Or maybe 5% of America is worse than I am. That's what I wanted. And it said it was even better. Dear Mr. Mallinson, your credit score is such and such. And 48% of Americans are less trustworthy, less sexy, less worthwhile than you. Yeah. And I rested so well that night. Those stupid 48%. Those deadbeats, they don't take care of their business. I take care of my business. And so I decided I was gonna make a move now. Now I can do whatever I want. I'm free. And so I'm gonna look in on Craigslist. I'm gonna see what kind of houses are out there. Could I actually be a homeowner again? And that was quick. Because apparently crappy duplexes in Irvine are 1.2 million. What do you got to do? And what kind of life have you lived to make that kind of decision? A crappy house that I'm not proud of if I'm in that house. I'm kind of sad. 1.2 million? I mean, how many babies did you have to execute in some kind of gulag to find this as your reality? And nonetheless, I said, but there surely must be a better way. I mean, I could maybe get a motorcycle. That's cool. Did you know that if I just spend 1/10 of that down here in the harbor, I could get not an $800,000 Mission Viejo house, mind you, but I could get an $80,000 boat? And do you know how sexy an $80,000 boat is? The answer is very sexy. In fact, maybe too sexy. You know, you see some of these boats and they're like the boats, you'd say, maybe I should have a hip-hop video recorded here and there should be some ladies in the bikinis with the champagne. That is what you could get for $80,000. And you know why it's also sexy, you would think? Because people see you in the boat sitting there having your mojito, and you're sitting there with your, you know, I've got these Oaxacan shorts that I love, and I'm just sitting, very nice, airy shorts, and people would say, that man's sexy, because if a man can afford an $80,000 boat in Newport Beach, man, his house must be hot. But I would be living on the boat. It's a rich man, poor man thing. Two kinds of people live on the boat out there, the rich people and the poor people. I like this. So I convinced my wife, hey, listen, can I at least, I'm trying to finish this stupid book at the cards back there. It's called Sexy, Quest for Erotic Virtue in Perplexing Times. Can't finish it because I got to get on a boat to get away from the distractions. And I can write about 10,000 words a pop if I'm on this boat. So I Airbnb it. You should do this. You can get it for $110, even if tonight you get a little tipsy, go try to Airbnb a boat over there, and you can stay on a boat in the harbor, and it's gonna cost you $100 to $300, and it's gonna be great, because you got waterfront property, and it rocks you to sleep, and it's so beautiful, and so delightful, and so I'm writing so much. I say, baby girl, my lady Stacy, we've been married for 20-something years, can't remember exactly, and well, I mean, it's like 22? 21, that's good. Blackjack, don't bust. And then I say, baby, come on out here. You just got to sit on this boat for a second, you know? And so we're sitting on this boat. And I said, hey, did you see that boat over there? It's called Best Bud. You know that's a ganja reference, right? But it's like this really nice boat, this expensive boat, Best Bud. I'm like, yeah, I want, that's a sexy boat. I could actually get that boat because my credit is better than 48% of people and I don't have any other payments. I'm gonna get that boat. And we're sitting there and she says, no, man, that's not a sexy boat. That's not a sexy boat at all. And then as we're sitting there, we're just sitting there on this boat. And it was just a crap boat. And it was so nice. And the sun was setting. And there were these dolphins. And these dolphins are coming up. And it was the mama dolphin who's going to have a baby dolphin. That's sexy. And the daddy dolphin, like, he cares. And he was there. That was really cool. So daddy dolphin and mama dolphin are coming. They're just riding along. And I said, I'm seeing a dolphin in the harbor. And we're having $3 chuck. And it was delightful, the $3 chuck, right? And the sun was setting. And then this older couple that I wish I could be, they came by and they had a little, you know, inexpensive boat. And they came over and they got this inexpensive boat. They go onto their boat to find whatever they left there. And I said, hey there, buddy, have you seen that boat called Good Bud? Do you want to buy the boat called Good Bud? And this old guy who was in love with his baby girl, and he said, no, not yet. I'm not interested right now. And I said, that's right. Because I realized by the end of this evening that there was nothing else in the world I needed. And as I'm writing my book, my lady, Stacy, is reading a book by a guy named Paul Zoll, David's father. And it's called, You Gotta Get This Book, Knuckleheads. Get this book. I'm serious. And it's called Grace in Practice. And so she's every once in a while just interrupting me. And she says, you gotta put this in. You got to mention this kind of thing, or this is going to be helpful. And we are marinating in the gospel. We are marinating in the California sunset, and the dolphins are dancing before us. And then I felt a little bit of sadness, a little tear, a little tragedy, because I thought about the man who owns Good Bud. Why is he selling his boat? How much slavery went into him overreaching to get that boat while he's not even there, because he's a slave for 50 weeks, and then 2 weeks he's got free, and on those 2 weeks he's supposed to go on the boat, but his baby girl doesn't want to go on the boat. She wanted to see her aunt in Ohio. So now he can't go on the boat. He's still paying for the slip, and he don't get to see his boat. And he's misshapen. He is working himself to death. And you know what else? Nobody else was on their boat. We, my lady and I, for $110, owned the marina. We owned the marina. For $110 and a glass of wine, we owned the marina. So this week, I went and I said, what is the cheapest crap boat I can get? And I got a $1,700 boat in Dana Point. And I said, we're going to pay cash for this, because why do I need to stretch myself now that I can get credit? I'm free to get credit. That doesn't necessarily mean I should do it, because it got me into trouble last time. And so now I'm sitting on this boat, and we say, this, friends, is the sexiest thing in the world when we're sitting there marinating in grace. So this reminded me of the Taoist philosopher Zhang Xuanzu, who writes, we cling to this body that we are given. We rush through our lives helter-skelter, clashing with this, bowing to that. We race like a wild stallion, which nothing can impede. Should we not be pitied? Working and striving and wasting our vital energies, exhausting ourselves, finding no comfort or peace, and not even able to derive the slightest satisfaction from our achievements. Is this not tragic? Should we not be pitied? Yeah, because this is the definition of sin, according to Saint Augustine. Sin is misdirected love, and the misdirected love misshapes and disfigures us. And when I was on that boat with my lady, I was surfing the Tao. That's what I call it. And you might say, hey there, Mr. Christian guy who teaches at a very conservative, you don't know conservative until you meet some Germanic Lutheran conservatives. We eat our own babies. We've got all the gospel in our books, but then we hide little throwing stars in them and get you if you do it wrong, and that's all right, but we love you, kind of, we try. But but I'm surfing the Dow. How is this? Well, because I want to appeal to the C.S. Lewis license. C.S. Lewis gets away with murder. C.S. Lewis, his letters are held at Wheaton College, and they basically worship this guy like an evangelical saint, yeah. But he could not teach at Wheaton if he was alive, right? Not even close. But he gets a little bit of credit. I like the credit that he gets, and he gets a little paganism in there, a little bit of inclusivism and, you know, quasi-universalism in there. But he also talks about the Tao, and I like it because it's one syllable, natural law. Too many syllables. I don't have time for this, so I like the Tao. But also, the Tao means the way, and the way is what we're all after. And you might say, no, Mr. All the world religions aren't saying the same thing. I said, no. We're not all saying the same thing, but we're all after the way. Show me the way to go home. I'm tired. I want to go. Show me the way to go home. So the way, the Tao, the Dharma, the Logos of the Stoics and the Christians, the Torah, the question is, what is the way? So I like this. I like using the language of the Tao. Now, in the Taoist philosophers, there's this idea of Wu Wei. It's going with the flow, but it's not a passive thing, or at least not the way I want to use it. I talk about surfing the Tao, just like those beautiful animals, like the dolphins, they can surf the surf, which is, here is this natural motion of the universe, and you can see it as terrifying and destructive. Every time I get old, you know, my family's from out, like, the East Coast, New Jersey and such, they don't go to the ocean like we got here. So they come out here, and what do? They always just get just into the breakers, and they almost drown. And I say, please just come on out and surf the Tao with me, or surf something, but just get out of it. And they're like, no, if it's scary here, it'll be worse there. And they're getting hurt. And so surfing the Tao is a way of managing this crazy, chaotic life and being able to play in it. And the only way you play in it is when you don't have to perform, but you can relax a little bit and just kind of, well, hang loose, I suppose, is the last thing Alistair McGrath ever said to me. Not a very kind of, you know, he doesn't have a knack for, you know, kind of conversation like a prof. He just said, hang loose. That was the last thing he said to me. But I'm not talking about Taoism because I'm into some kind of New Agey thing, because ultimately I say that the Tao, or the way, is, for me, Jesus. I mean, it is, I say, not just for me, but it is what I say is the deeper magic behind it all. Jesus, important because of the incarnation. That this idea, the opening line of the Tao Te Ching, the Tao that can be spoken is not the eternal Tao, I agree, but the Tao that is embodied in a dude who then desires us so much that he impales himself as he's running to the unlovable. Now that's something interesting. And that creates a whole different universe for us. Baby girl, would you tell me when I have 5 minutes left, because I lost my track? It doesn't matter. Somebody will flag me down. Jesus delivers the deeper magic in the middle of the Tao, but unfortunately, we Christians are too often like the old legalists. Now, who are these guys? The Taoists themselves, the old Chinese philosophers. If you don't like me talking about them, Christian friends, you got to understand that you also got to get rid of Socrates and Plato, or else you're a racist. Because Socrates and Plato were pagans, and the Chinese weren't Christians, and that's fine, but they were philosophers. So if you don't like different colored skin philosophers, then you're a racist. So don't write to my college president and tell me that I shouldn't be talking about the Taoists. But I love the Taoists because the Taoists were opposing two groups. They opposed the legalists, who thought that the best life, that the good life would be created by a lot of good rules, a well-ordered society, and they opposed the Confucians, who were basically like the old-school Chinese focus on the family. Why are the gays pulling apart the fabric of society? I'm sorry I did that for my Kentucky friends in the Southern accent. We have crazies here in California as well. In fact, we're in the Bible Belt. We're in like the Southern California Bible Belt, so we can't judge. It's just more fun to say it with a Southern man accent. But so too often we Christians, as we're talking about this conversation about sex, what we really get into is that we're really good at articulating the rules that we find in Scripture about sexuality, but we're not very good at learning how to form, to catechize, to model, to discover a language of a community that is able to shape a way of being in which the sexual ethics that Christianity seems to suggest are important make sense. And therefore, we absolutely must reframe our conversation about sexuality. And it's not really just about sexuality, but this is a prime place for us to start thinking about it, because our failure to recognize that we are speaking different languages when we talk about these things in the popular context, it creates confusion and needless offense. St. Paul understood this in 1 Corinthians 5. He says, I write to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people, not at all meaning the sexually immoral of this world or the greedy and the swindlers or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. Then he goes on, is it not those inside the church who you're to judge? Now, there's enough of that too, my friends. But what I'm saying here is he at least recognizes here that there is a different language. And so instead of nagging outsiders, we have to remember that many today, and especially young people, remain in a living erotic hell, and they know it. The problem is they just often think of Christian teaching related to these things as superstitious taboos. Now, taboos by their very nature, taboos are manifestations of the breakdown of virtue, the breakdown of true ethics. Taboos are the remnant of old rules that we forgot why they were there. And sometimes they might be valuable, but we don't know. It's kind of like that old thing in Lost, like push this button, and, I don't know, push the button. This kind of thinking, though, taboo or legalistic thinking, divorces sexual ethics from God's grace, his loving kindness. And what we see is that taboo really comes from the experience of Captain Cook. Captain Cook comes from a very, you know, very seriously sexually conservative community of Europe. And he travels out on the high seas, and his sailor buddies, they get there to the Polynesian Islands, and then also in Hawaii, and they see that they're not wearing clothes, and sometimes they're very promiscuous. They're having multiple sexual partners, and yet they don't. Men and women don't eat together. So the Captain Cook and the sailors would ask, "Well, what's up here? Why is it that you're very promiscuous here, but men and women can't eat together?" And they say, well, that's kapu or taboo. This is bad magic. But why is it bad magic? We don't remember. Now, probably what happened is the dudes just wanted a little peace and quiet. They were on an island, or the ladies wanted peace and quiet. I don't mean to be sexist about this, because the rest of the time they were in the game of romance. I have no idea. But the idea is that they had disconnected, they had unmoored their teachings, their rules, from the source or the motivator or the reason for those rules. My favorite ethicist, he's a Lutheran ethicist that was at Valparaiso, Gilbert Mylander, writes, "This Christian teaching, whatever it is, it was intended to be taught, but taught within an ongoing life of a worshiping community of believers. Abstracted from that way of life, particular rules for Christian living may lack intelligibility and will almost surely lack the power to persuade or the beauty to attract." So when I talk about sexy, being sexy is about seducing our world back to a gracious, true love that they gave up on some time ago. Sometime I'm going to date it back in the 60s when John Updike was writing the Rabbit books or something. It's just like the end of sex as something sexy. And seducing our world back to this gracious love is about figuring out who we are, who we want to be. And maybe, going back to what we had heard about Luther, going back a little farther, St. Augustine said something that's very dangerous to some: love God and do what you want. And you say, oh, good. Okay, but let's be serious about this first part. What does this mean? It is not a law. It's an invitation. It's a possibility. When I suggest that there is a need for more grace in the conversation about sexuality, please do not accuse me of being spineless or accommodating or overly permissive. I want to go the other way. But I want to go the other way in a different way than it's, I think, been described in our culture today, because the way we've been doing it is just, at the empirical level, wrong. I care about kids. I'm a professor that teaches young people, and their lives are a wreck very often, and I'm just pissed because I get involved in all this nonsense about the abstractions when I'm dealing with actual human beings whose lives are broken, and sometimes these lives are broken because of the people who are on my case for the way I'm making the case, and I'm kind of tired of them being in my business. Because 48%, this is the national, these are the national numbers, who cares if they're exact, 48% of 17-year-olds in America will have had sexual activity, intercourse. They've done it by the age of 17. 71% by the age of 19. So 71% of young people by the age of 19 will have had sexual intercourse. And that's, you know, that's the world. That's why we send our kids to Christian schools. Except 80% of young evangelicals, according to the National Association of Evangelicals, 80% of young evangelicals by the time they're 19 have had sexual intercourse. That means 9% more of the, but you know, they ain't nobody move me like the son of a preacher man. I got my 5-minute time run. Go watch the movie Saved if you want to see how this kind of plays out. Because the worst part, and now we're having laughing and now we're going to get a little uncomfortable, but that's okay, go pee sometimes if you don't want to mix it up, distract me. Almost a third of evangelicals' unwanted pregnancies end in abortions. You say, oh, but don't we have the signs? Yeah, but do you know where I don't want to be pregnant on out of wedlock? We never use the word wedlock unless we're like, you know, in this kind of church context. At a church or a Christian university or with a conservative Christian faith, I don't want that because I don't feel like I'm safe enough to make that kind of mistake. And the problem is, even in our Christian communities, we fail to offer a different formation or a counter formation. The scholar J.K.A. Smith calls this a secular liturgy. It's the idea that the Christian kids themselves, the Christian parents, all of us, we have been molded by a cultural liturgy that basically has misguided or misshapen assumptions about what marriage is supposed to be or what a relationship is supposed to be. And the marriage is supposed to fulfill my every need. I'm looking for the one. I want to be in the notebook. I want this other person to complete everything in me that is lacking. And what this means, if we both accept this liturgy, is we're screwed. We will not be successful. We cannot be successful. Because if we compromise 10% here to serve your needs there, then I am going to be unfulfilled. And I mean, I need to get out of the relationship because you're not fulfilling my every need. And if you sacrifice for me as my partner, then you are going to be unfulfilled. And so something must be wrong. And the secular world has the one, and it's scientific and sexual and psychological. And the Christian world has the one. They throw in a little bit of providence. If you're a Calvinist, knock it off. There is no the one. And so I say to my kids and I say to young people, you should tell somebody on the first day, this is especially dudes to ladies, and this is not to be sexist, but because of the certain power dynamics in many relationships, but I say this especially to my sons. On the first day, say, I love you. Think about this. If I say, you should say, I love you on the first date, and that bothers you, you need to ask yourself, why does that bother you? It bothers you because you swallowed a secular liturgy accidentally. Because that should be perfectly natural for a Christian. Everyone you meet, this is a child or a daughter of God or a son of God, and you say, I love you with an infinite love. It's only possible with agape love. It's only possible with the Tao surfing that I'm talking about. And if you have the Tao surfing, you have absolutely everything. And now there is nothing to be figured out. There's nothing to gain. There's nothing to lose. There's nothing to exchange. I love you. And baby, I'm telling you, I love you. I really love you. I love you 100%. I love you. I love you, and I'm sometimes not going to be able to do it, but I love you. Now, the question is if I can put up with your crap for another week. But that's a live question, right? And once you change this, what happens? What happens is no longer just sexuality. You still might do it because you just, you know, your kids or whatever, but you are not going to do it to try to gain something that you didn't have, which is completion, acceptance, love. Now you're not making love, you have love. And the only question is, who am I? And who am I in Christ? And who am I going to be with that's going to help me realize my true self, my genuine self? And with two things. First, I got some other Bible verses, but you'll permit me to go back to the Tao Te Ching. The Tao Te Ching means the classic text on Tao, the way, and de, virtue. Blows my mind, this text.
Lao Tzu says this. Lose Tao and De follows. Lose De and benevolence follows. Lose benevolence and righteousness follows. Lose righteousness and propriety follows. Propriety dilutes loyalty and sincerity. Confusion begins. Let me explain. The only way for you to have the power to be a decent person that you've internalized, you say, I want to love, I want to care. The only way to do this is to marinate in the gospel. And for all the haters that are always giving trouble to people saying, you've given too much love, too much gospel, you're too open to the broken, hurting bums out there in the world, I say, if you think it doesn't work, I'm very worried that you might not have tasted and seen that the Lord is good. Now, my son in the book responds in every chapter with 750 words. I might throw him off, but what he basically said was my favorite one he's done so far. And he says, sometimes, Dad, when you and your colleagues are debating how much gospel you're allowed to dispense, how much love, how much grace is permissible to dispense, you sound a lot, you professors of theology, sound a lot like my buddies in middle school in the locker room debating about sexual technique. I'm pretty sure you've got a lot of opinions, but I'm not sure you've ever done the thing itself. And I thought, he's probably right, because there's dudes that get it. I want to say the guy coming up next, all the Zols, man. I don't know if you have like a cousin that's a guy, but the Zols get it. And once somebody gets it, it's kind of like you don't really have to defend it anymore, right? Because you understand that there's a power in this. But in the story here, of the way that the Taoists worked, it was if you lose touch with the gospel, if you lose touch with the true reality of the universe, that everything is going to be okay, that God's got this thing, that's okay, God, it's all right, then you can be good. But when you lose touch with the Tao, when you lose touch with reality, then you starve your virtue. But that's okay, because you give to charity and you volunteer. That's cool. But then you get tired of that, because you're not virtuous anymore. You don't have it in you. So you just say, well, listen, I'm going to be self-righteous. That's the next part of that. I haven't killed anybody. I don't do those bad things. But notice where we are in this culture right now. We're at this last part, propriety. You know what this means? This is etiquette. This is protocol. I'm in the college world, and the only thing colleges are talking about these days when it comes to sexual ethics isn't what I call ethics as a professor of philosophy and theology. They're talking about asking permission before you touch a breast. And if there's a little bit of alcohol, now can I, is this way, can I do that? You know, and that is where we're at. And that isn't sexy. That's nothing, man. You mean all we got left is figuring out where I can put my hands with a certain kind of contract in a certain kind of situation so that I'm a just man? That ain't justice. That's just a way of dealing with this prison hell that we found ourselves in that is nihilistic, has no meaning, and we're going nowhere. But what if we got something else? What if we really trusted in this kind of gracious love that is infinite and that we spill out to the world and there's nothing to stop just spilling it out? What if that's the thing we're thinking about? Then we are shaped by an entirely different logic. It's a new logic. And my wife came up with this when she was listening to David Zoll, so I got to get off and let him do this thing, because that's the thing, man. That's why I made my dad come, because you got to see Zoll. Because Stacy said, for all these people who are down on the group of people who are giving out too much love, giving out too much gospel, what's really strange was at this conference we were at, there was a lot of law stabbing into the depths of who we were. The only reason we could allow it to happen, Stacy said, is because in my tribe, the Lutherans, we talk about law and gospel, but we turn it sometimes into a formula, like here's the law part, now comes the gospel part. And there's, you know, look, when you're going to screw it up, pastors, if you're a pastor in here, go for that. That's great. You know, it's like, well, if you want to use the nine iron, that's great. Just don't screw it up too bad. That's great. But here's a better way to do it. Gospel, law, gospel. Think of it like a hospital. If you come into a community that you know is already saturated in grace and unconditional love, you can then let down your guard. There is nothing to be lost. There's nothing to be gained. You can be honest. And the only way for your sexual lives and your relationships and your marriage to ever get better is to stop bullcrapping about your own defensiveness. There's only one book, if you really are in trouble in your marriage or whatever, there's only one book that's on this, you know, the secular world that works because it's researched. John Gottman. Anything by this guy John Gottman will do you well. But he says one of the ways that you can destroy a relationship, it's almost doomed to fail, is if people have defensiveness. Because once you're dealing in the world of law, then you just put up your defenses. It's like, you know, none of the Republicans can apologize for, you know, well, some of them, but, you know, it's like you can't apologize because you've got to defend. But what if you don't have to defend? What if you can be honest and you can say you're sorry? What happens then? Then what happens is then you can have the surgery of the law, and then the law is going to rip out the toxic parts of you. Gospel makes you safe to have the surgery. And once you have the surgery, what do you need? You need to be bandaged up. You need to be salved. You need to be nurtured back to health in a world that understands that unless we get right spiritually, we are never going to get right in our erotic lives. And so as I've said before, and I guess I'll close with this, get your hearts in the right place, friends, and maybe your genitals will follow along on the way to true love.